Joel, prophet of the 20th century. We've gone into parts of the prophet Joel before in other sermons in various subjects. However, there are many new people on our tape ministry who are not familiar with the Old Testament to any extent at all. And so what I'm going to do is just go to this one prophet and we'll read it all the way through to demonstrate how God, several millenniums ago, gave a prophecy to a prophet which is easily shown to be coming to pass right before our very eyes in this 20th century. And I pray that by doing this, it at least will spark some interest and curiosity among people new to the identity message to really search the Old Testament prophets and read them and to correlate together, as they will then see the marvelous unfolding of these writings that can only be miraculous, it can only be God-breathed, because certainly no man could write things several thousand years ago which can be so easily demonstrated to fit modern history. So we'll begin in the very first verse, and we'll go all the way through in several sermons. Joel 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Hear this, ye old men, and give ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Hath this been in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? So he begins by a question which demonstrates that whatever it is he's going to talk about is not past history at Joel's time, and it's not current history. It isn't something that's happening in their days or in the days of their fathers. And then he says, tell your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and their children another generation. Which is an idiom for saying this is a prophecy of the future. You pass this on down through generations. And then he starts in a very strange way. That which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left hath the cankerworm eaten, and that which the cankerworm hath left hath the caterpillar eaten. That's a strange way to start what is supposed to be a very important future prophecy. And, of course, it could be a riddle, although at least the farmers will recognize it must have something to do with things being eaten up and almost totally destroyed, because it isn't just one worm, it's a worm following a worm following a worm, eating whatever is left that they are eating on. Verse 5, awake, ye drunkards, and weep and howl, all ye drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation is come upon my land, strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the cheek teeth of the great lion, hath laid my vine waste, and barked my fig tree, he hath made it clean bare, and cast it away, the branches thereof are made white. So this is a nation, he refers to these worms, caterpillars, eating something up, and immediately says, a nation, or the Hebrew word is goy there, which is translated people. About half of the time in the Old Testament, a people is come upon my land strong and without number. And then he describes it as having the teeth of a lion, and they laid his vine waste and barked his fig tree. Now we'll turn to other parts of the Bible to identify the characters and places in this prophecy. So turn back to Isaiah 5. Isaiah 5 begins as an allegory. Now will I sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. Here's that same entity that we read in Joel, a vineyard. My beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. And he fenced it and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it and also made a winepress therein. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. So then he tells what in effect is a parable. And then he goes down, or we'll go down to verse 5, and we'll find out what the vineyard is in Isaiah 5. It says in verse 7, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. So the story in Isaiah identifies the vineyard as Israel. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 4. In verse 7 we read, God is speaking through the prophet, I have forsaken mine house, I have left mine heritage, I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. And we know, of course, that God's heritage is the house of Israel, and we can verify that in Joel, going back to the prophet we're talking about here. Joel chapter 3 and verse 2, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. So God's heritage is Israel. Now if you've kept your finger in Jeremiah 12, we'll read on. He said in verse 7, he had forsaken his house, I have left mine heritage. So God's heritage is Israel, as we know from Joel. Verse 8, mine heritage is unto me as a lion in the forest. It crieth out against me, therefore have I hated it. Mine heritage is unto me as a speckled bird. The birds round about it are against her. Come, assemble all the beasts of the field, come to devour. Many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. So here he uses the word vineyard again for his heritage, which is identified as the house of Israel. Many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. So God's vineyard is the house of Israel. And when we begin reading in Joel here, we must know what is being wasted, what is being plundered in this prophecy that Joel says is of the future. You tell your children and their children on down through the generations, and it obviously is Israel. So let's go on in Joel 1 now reading and understanding what it is that is being wasted here in this prophet Joel. Joel 1 verse 8, he says, lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. Now, why would these people lament for the husband of their youth? Well, let's turn back to Jeremiah 3, and we'll understand why he is saying to Israel that this is what they're to do in this time when they're robbed and plundered. In Jeremiah 3, in verse 8, we find God saying, and I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. So God was the husband of Israel's youth, yet he divorced her. He divorced her and put her away. Verse 12, he told the prophet, go and proclaim the words toward the north and say, return thou backsliding Israel, this is divorced Israel, saith the Lord, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. Only acknowledge thine iniquity, that thou hast transgressed against the Lord thy God, and hast scattered thy ways to the strangers under every green tree. And remember, Israel was accused of harlotry, adultery, because she went and worshipped other gods, which were the reason for the divorce. And ye have not obeyed my voice, saith the Lord. Turn, O backsliding children, the Lord, for I am married unto you. So God said, I divorced Israel. And then he sent the prophet to them and said, turn to me, for I am married unto you. That's a strange thing for a husband to say to a divorced wife. Turn over to Isaiah, and you should read all of chapter 1 to set the stage for this, because God had Hosea take an harlot for a wife, which, of course, Israel was. She represented Israel, and then she had children. And then we read in chapter 2, as he speaks of this wife, mother, which represented Israel, chapter 2, verse 1, say unto your brethren, Ammi, that is my people, and to your sisters, Ruhamah, that is meaning the one who has obtained mercy, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Which was true because God had divorced Israel. Now the prophet is to say to her, you're not my wife and I'm not your husband. And then he was to go on in verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her paths, and she shall follow after her lovers, meaning her other gods, but she shall not overtake them, and she shall seek them, shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. This is a prophecy that divorced Israel would eventually say, I will go back to my first husband. And then in Joel we read that Israel, which was being robbed and plundered by these caterpillars and worms, was going to say, I will return to the husband of my youth. We're talking about the same entity and the same prophecy. And of course in Hosea 2, We could read a little more because there is a specific prophecy that God would then betroth Israel and marry her. Verse 14, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her, and part of that comfort would be, verse 19 and 20, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. So, God had said in a prophecy of Hosea that Israel eventually would say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. And then he prophesied the betrothal, which of course is what we're reading here in Joel, that he speaks through this prophet to Israel sometime long after Joel was living, and he tells them they are being robbed and plundered, and then he says to them in verse 8 of Joel, lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. Israel would lament and want, desire, would want to return to her first husband. So these prophecies all fit. Joel is speaking to the vineyard, which is the house of Israel, God's divorced wife. Now the question is, as I read this, and it'll be raised all through this reading of Joel, will Israel have to be in this condition described here before she will lament for the husband of her youth, before she will turn back to her first husband? Now, even if she will say, it was better for me then than it is now, which makes it appear that she's going to be in a terrible state when this turning does take place. But the turning will come, so let's read on in Joel. After he tells her to do this, then he describes the condition of this vineyard, the Lord of hosts, the house of Israel. The meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests, the Lord's ministers, mourn. That simply says that the tithes and the offerings are not being given to the priests, to God's ministers. The field is wasted, the land mourneth, for the corn is wasted, the new wine is dried up, the oil languisheth. Be ye ashamed, O ye husbandmen, howl, O ye vine dressers, and that would be a reference to the people who are the rulers and controllers over Israel. They're the ones in charge of the vineyard, and he's telling them they should be ashamed for the wheat and for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. Now, as I read this, does not necessarily mean simply the material things have been taken away from Israel. It could mean spiritual things also. The vine is dried up, and the fig tree languishes. The pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, and the apple tree, even all the trees of the field, are withered, because joy is withered away from the sons of men. Gird yourselves and lament, ye priests, howl, ye ministers of the altar, come, lie all night in sackcloth, ye ministers of my God, for the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. Now, I believe this is a call or a command to God's true ministers. He's not talking about false prophets here per se. He refers to them as the ministers of the altar, the ministers of my God, and he tells them to cry aloud, and the reason they're to cry aloud is that the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. Now, to see the seriousness of this, let's turn over to another well-known passage, or at least it used to be, the very last book in the Old Testament, in Malachi, chapter 3. We'll begin in verse 7. God, through the prophet, is rebuking these same people of Israel, and he says, even from the days of your fathers ye are gone away from my ordinances, and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord. Now, before we discuss how telling them to return, think of that phrase, and you will find that said in scores and scores of different ways in the Old Testament and the New. You turn unto God, and he'll turn unto you. You see, we want God's favor and we want God's blessing, but we want it without having to turn unto him. He's telling Israel, you return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return? He's saying Israel doesn't know how to return. He doesn't know what she's supposed to do. Here's God's answer. Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me, but ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? So they don't know that they've robbed God. He's telling them to turn. They don't know how to turn. He shows them what they should do, and they don't even know they've not done what they're supposed to do. Ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? Here's God's answer. In tithes and offerings. That's what the priests were told to cry aloud here in Joel about, that the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. And here in Malachi, God is accusing the whole nation of Israel of robbing him by withholding the tithes and the offerings to the house of God. Verse 9 of Malachi 3, ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Now, you interpolate that on down to modern Israel today, and is not Israel robbing God? The major denominations admit in their annual statistics, if you'll take their membership and divide it by their estimated total offerings, they get as low as 1%, and a few of them get as high as 2% of the estimated earnings of their members. That means they get from 1/10 to as high as 1/5 of the tithe. And that's only those people who are members and attend churches. About 50% of our people do not attend churches of any kind at all, and apparently give no tithe at all. So how much are we robbing God year after year in tithes and offerings? And that's what God said here in Malachi. He says, ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. And then he tells them what they should do, which is the answer to their question, how shall we turn to God? Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house, and prove me, or test me. Now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And listen what he says he would do. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sake, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts. Now in Joel, what were we reading? We were reading that these worms and caterpillars were devouring the harvest of the land of Israel. In Malachi, God says, if you will not rob me of my tithes and offerings, if you will give them to me, I will rebuke that devourer who devours the work of your hands and the fruit of your ground. Neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time of the field, saith the Lord of hosts. And all nations shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. Now there's a whole sermon in the course following this on through the rest of the chapter 4, because it is obviously then an end-time sermon, just like Joel is. We'll not cover that, but I wanted to point out to you that Malachi also has been given to lay out the truth that God Almighty will honor Israel and protect them from the devourer of the work of their hands if they will give their tithes and offerings to the house of God. And here in Joel, he describes a tremendous eating up of the vineyard of the Lord of hosts, and the priests are to gird themselves and lament and howl, and they were to lie all night in sackcloth, ye ministers of my God, not specifically praying for the removal of the caterpillars and the locusts and the canker worms, but to be praying and pleading that God's people give the tithe to the house of God. Which in Malachi says, if you will do it, God will rebuke the devourer. Now, I attended a meeting in Shawnee, Tennessee here just a few weeks ago, as you know. And I was pleased with the number of people there who want to turn to God and want to do things right in God's sight. However, the main reason they were there in Shawnee, Tennessee, was to listen to speakers telling them how to save and husband and make their money grow bigger and bigger so they can get wealthy or retain their wealth in the so-called collapse that is to come. Now, they were trying and talking about all sorts of things, gold and silver, stocks and bonds, not paying your taxes, or whatever. God says to the house of Israel through these prophets, there is one way you can retain and obtain wealth in Israel, that is to give God your tithes and offerings. And you see, we ministers, and I'll include myself in this, we have been guilty of neglecting to tell you, to some extent, I've been guilty of this, of not telling the people the importance of tithing to the house of God. You don't do it so the pastor can have a lot of money. You don't do it so you can go on all sorts of radio broadcasts and tell how many caterpillars and cankerworms and locusts there are in God's vineyard. You tithe because God says, if you do it, I will rebuke the devourer. And I'll set your land aright, and I'll cleanse your land. Now, I realize, as I say this, and I hope that you do also, that the non-Christian and the unbeliever is not going to tithe to God's birth in God's house. So we're talking about people who have gotten their heart right with God. They're Christians. They're believers. They want to obey God and do His word and His law. All right. What's one of the first things you do? You begin to tithe to the house of God. It's a very simple thing. You know how much you make. If you don't, you're supposedly, some of you at least, put it down on that little form every year that you send into the Internal Revenue Service, so you know how much your income was, or gain or loss, or whatever it was during the year. So God is not asking you to do something that you can't figure out how to do. You might have a horrible time quitting smoking, because I know they put addictive drugs in the tobacco anymore, and that could be a terrible thing to try to get away from, especially if you've been smoking for 10 or 20 years. But in 5 minutes, you can compute what your tithe should be to the house of God. It's not a big problem. It may take you more than 5 minutes to actually give it, but it wouldn't take you more than 5 minutes to figure out how much it is. And both of these prophets emphasize God's blessings will come upon a nation that quit robbing God in tithes and offerings. And here in Joel, these ministers are to lie all night in sackcloth, and here's the reason. For the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. Israel is not giving their tithes. That's why the caterpillars and the locusts and the cankerworms are there. All right, he goes on instructing the ministers. Sanctify ye a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God, and cry unto the Lord. Alas, for the day of the Lord is at hand, and as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. That's the message, that's the preaching that these ministers are to tell the people. The day of the Lord is at hand. Now, most ministers that I hear, or whose material I read, speak of the day of the Lord in reference to the return of Jesus Christ and the rapture. That's what they have in their mind and they think of it. And they talk about it as a joyous day and a wonderful meeting of Christ, and then we're going to go off to heaven and so on. But here, this prophet is supposed to tell the people and pass this on for generation after generation, that at this time, when this comes to pass, the ministers are to tell the people, alas for the day of the Lord is at hand, and as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. Now, we'll read more about this as we go on in Joel, and for those who are fairly new to some of the things that we teach, I would suggest they get my 4-sermon series on the day of the Lord. We've got that on 2 cassettes. Number 7202 and number 7203. The subject is broad enough, so I sent 4 sermons on it. I'm not going to get into it now, but you'll discover that the day of the Lord, according to God's word, is quite different than the day of the Lord as it is preached in most churches today. As a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. Is not the meat cut off from before our eyes? Yea, joy and gladness from the house of our God. The seed is rotten under their clods, the garners are laid desolate, the barns are broken down, for the corn is withered. How do the beasts groan? The herds of cattle are perplexed, because they have no pasture. Yea, the flocks of sheep are made desolate. And remember, as you read this, this is not necessarily just a physical desolation in the land of Israel. This could be a spiritual desolation too. Even some of the phraseology here in the names, the flocks of the sheep are made desolate. God's Israel people, the Christian church, is referred to as sheep, made desolate by the times and the preaching. O Lord, to thee will I cry, for the fire hath devoured the pasture of the wilderness, and the flame hath burned all the trees of the field. The beasts of the field cry also unto thee, for the rivers of waters are dried up, and the fire hath devoured the pastures of the wilderness. Now the stage is set in America, and in fact, the play is already underway for both the physical fulfillment of this and the spiritual fulfillment. In the actual or the material fulfillment, we know that our rivers, our underwater rivers in some of the parts of the United States, are drying up. They tell us that within 20 years, the Ogallala Aquifer of western Kansas and western Nebraska and the panhandle of Texas will be completely dry, and it will put several million farm acres will become desert and dust, and there's no other source of water. The same thing is true all over the Southwest. We are pumping out our groundwater, and soon we'll have to quit irrigating lands where we get the water from beneath the surface of the land. So that is coming past, or can come to pass physically, and then we also have the spiritual drying up of the water of the Word of God in this land. So there may be a double fulfillment here. God goes on to the prophet, chapter 2, blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. So now we have a place. We have a people, we've identified them as Israel, which is being destroyed in this prophecy. We have another people, not yet identified, but called locusts and caterpillars and so on, who are doing the destroying. We have a time called the Day of the Lord, and now we have a place. It is in Zion, in God's holy mountain. And I won't take a lot of time in this sermon to tell you that I believe that this North American continent is the Zion of Bible prophecy. I have perhaps 20 of sermons in my cassette catalog that you can listen to where we identify the regathering of Israel here on this North American continent. So this is Zion. What are the ministers to do in Zion? Blow ye the trumpet and sound an alarm. And my holy mountain, of course, is my holy nation, is also used in Isaiah as the place of the kingdom. And here's why they are to blow the alarm. For the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. Here's what it is. A day of darkness and of gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong. There hath not been ever the like, neither shall there be any more after it, even to the years of many generations. Not a very pleasant picture painted by the prophet Joel of the day of the Lord. And here he referred again to this great people and strong. That's what we read in Joel 1, verse 6. For a nation is come upon my land, strong and without number. In other words, a great people has come into the land of Israel, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the cheek teeth of a great lion. He hath laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. I should go back here real quick to Jeremiah, because I didn't explain the fig tree, and I'm sure some will be asking. Turn to Jeremiah 24. Jeremiah 24 identifies the fig tree. The Lord showed me, and behold, two baskets of figs were set before the temple of the Lord, after that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away captive Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and the princes of Judah with the carpenters and smiths from Jerusalem, and had brought them to Babylon. So this is the nation of Judah now in Babylon. And God showed him two baskets of figs. Verse 2, one basket had very good figs, even like the figs that are first ripe, and the other basket had very naughty figs, which could not be eaten. They were so bad. And then he goes on, you should read the rest of that chapter, to describe two parts of the Judah kingdom. One good figs, and God would work on them for good, and one evil figs, but both of Judah. So I believe the fig here, identified in Joel, of course, is the house of Judah. So it's not the vineyard of the Lord of hosts, it's the house of Israel. And we have the fig tree, which is also being destroyed, which is the Judah kingdom, which was separate at that time from Israel. All right, let's go back to Joel. In chapter 2, he described in verse 2 that the day of the Lord, a day of darkness and of gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong. There hath not ever been the like, neither shall be any more after it, even to the years of many generations. And that phraseology at the end implies that there will never be the like. It means for generation after generation, there will never be a people like that great people and strong. Before we finish this study, then I'll come back and discuss that phrase in verse 2 there, as the morning spread upon the mountain, because I believe it's very significant, although we'll not discuss it now. Then he goes on and describes this great people and strong. Verse 3, a fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness, yea, and nothing shall escape them. Communism, Red Bolshevism, the Antichrist. The people who have escaped from so-called communist countries over the years tell one story over and over. We had a green and fruitful country and beautiful cities. Now our land is barren and our cities are gray and bare. Communism does not produce. Communism only consumes and destroys. As an example of what they do, with the Garden of Eden before them and the desolate wilderness behind them, at the end of World War II, Eastern Europe was stripped. Whole factories in Eastern Europe were dismantled and shipped east. Houses and hotels and apartment buildings were stripped of their plumbing, even the windows taken out of the casing, and put on trucks and trains and sent to Russia. Refugees told of the cattle on the farms of Eastern Europe were simply rounded up in great herds and just simply driven east by forced labor onto the Soviet Union. German men and Poles and Czechs and Hungarians, hundreds of thousands, were lined up and marched east to Russia to the slave camps. Most of them never returned. About 2 million German soldiers captured by the Soviets were marched to the east, and only a few hundred have ever returned to their families in Germany. In East Prussia and Silesia, the Bolsheviks drove out 6 million Germans. Most of their ancestors had moved to that part of Europe centuries ago. 2 million were killed on the roads to West Germany before they arrived in the refuge of West Germany. All of their property that was left behind was confiscated by the communists. In country after country, I have talked to refugees who came from Cuba after Castro took over. Within 2 years, the Russians had come to Cuba, and they even went so far as to go to every luxury hotel and motel in Havana, and they stripped the buildings of all of the plumbing fixtures, the stools and the washbowls, and even the tile off the walls, and boxed it up and freighted it and sent it back to the Soviet Union. They confiscated the land from the farmers and set up communal farms. Prior to 1959, Cuba had the second highest standard of living in the Western Hemisphere, exceeded only by the United States of America. Within 10 years, by 1969, it was the lowest, and people were attempting to escape out of communism by boats and dying at sea off of the coast of Florida. Every communist country has a percentage of its people starving, whether in slave camps or in the streets and villages. And God describes through the prophet this great people and strong that would come upon Israel at the end of this age. A fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness. Yea, and nothing shall escape them. The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, and as horsemen so shall they run. The most powerful thing in that day was a horse, or especially a horse that was used in war. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of mountains shall they leap, like the noise of a flame of fire that devoureth the stubble, as a strong people set in battle array. The Red Bolsheviks are at war. They are in a battle. They are set in battle array against God's people, against Israel and Judah, and the tragedy is that most of Israel and Judah do not even know this enemy is waging war against them. Verse 6, before their face the people shall be much pained. All faces shall gather blackness, or be darkened, or cast down. In other words, the people whom they face will always lose, defeat after defeat, as the communists would march across the earth. Verse 7, they shall run like mighty men. They shall climb the wall like men of war, and they shall march every one on his ways, and they shall not break their ranks. Every defector from the Communist Party in America or in other nations has testified of the total discipline inside the Communist Party. Kenneth Goff, who was in the Communist Party in the 30s, later was converted and became a preacher. I've heard him speak a number of times. I heard him one time say, and this is almost a quote, "Party members often gave 20% and 30% and even 50% of their salary to the party, plus hours and hours of time every week." And Kenneth Goff said, and I can vouch for it truthfulness, "I have never found a Christian dedicated to that extent that they would give 50% of their earnings and hours of their week to Christian work." But he said, and other communists have said the same thing, party members will do it. They are dedicated and disciplined. In fact, Whitaker Chambers and Kenneth Goff both told the same story, that they knew that if they simply left the party, they would be killed. And they spent about a year figuring out a way to get away from the party to a place of safety, because they knew the discipline inside the American Communist Party was such that defectors were immediately murdered when they left. "They shall march everyone in their ways, and they shall not break their ranks. Neither shall one trust another. They shall walk everyone in his path, and when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded." Patriotic and Christian Americans have been fighting and exposing the communists in America for over 75 years. What have been the results? Practically nothing. Have they destroyed any of the communists? They've not even caused them to lose their jobs in most cases. Some of them who were pointed out in the federal government were promoted after they were named as communists. Of convictions for being communists, Rosenberg and Alger Hiss and a few more, probably less than 25 or 30 people in the last 75 years. In 1960, I heard a U.S. Naval Intelligence officer say that as early as 1945, at the end of World War II, U.S. Naval Intelligence had card files on over 2 million subversives in America, almost all of them communists. How many have ever been convicted and removed from their jobs in America? Under the administration of John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert as the Attorney General, those naval files on 2 million subversives were taken out and destroyed. They no longer exist. Senator Joe McCarthy, one of the few senators who ever had the guts to take on the communists in government, named over 300 of them who had jobs in the United States government. That was in the early 1950s. He was hounded to his death. Some say he was murdered. And his name today is synonymous with false accusations. Yet within 10 years after his death, almost every one of those 300 people had been identified by other sources or by their actions as communists. In the 20 years since he named those people, practically no communists have been convicted of anything or removed from the job in America. Over 15 years ago, Frank Capel wrote a book titled Kissinger, Soviet Agent. I don't know how many of you people even know that. He gave information out of U.S. government files that Henry Kissinger had worked with the Soviet Secret Service as an espionage agent in the U.S. Army in Europe. His book was entirely documented after it was published, several years after it was published. Henry Kissinger was made Secretary of State and under President Nixon was given charge of all U.S. internal security. Colonel Galinowski, a high Polish official, defected to the United States in the early 1960s. after smuggling information out of Poland to American agents for several years. He was flown to Washington, D.C. by a private or by an Air Force plane and taken in to Washington, to the Capitol, for a briefing with high U.S. officials, including cabinet members. He later wrote, and this is about a direct quote, "When I sat down at that table with the men in the highest positions of the U.S. government, I looked up to see sitting across from me a man I knew to be one of the Soviet top agents in America." That man was never removed from his work on his position in the United States government. Colonel Zelenowski still lives in New York City, and hardly a handful of Americans have ever heard his name. I do not know of one person ever removed from a position in the United States government because he's named by Zelenowski as a Soviet agent, and yet I understand that he gave the United States government over 1,600 names of people who were Soviet agents, either in Western Europe or in the United States. And I could go on and on, but it says here, "Neither shall one trust another, they shall walk everyone in his path, and when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. They shall run to and fro in the city, they shall run up on the wall, they shall climb up upon the houses," in other words, they'll be able to get in everything in the nation of Israel. "They shall enter in at the windows like a thief. The earth shall quake before them, the heavens shall tremble," and then listen to this, "the sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining." Jesus Christ, at that same time, used the same phrase. And that's a good place to stop. Next time, God willing, we'll pick up here in Joel about the day of the Lord and this time. Verse 10, "The sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining." Let's stand. Our Father and our God, we do pray in the name of Jesus Christ that you'll help us to understand your word and to recognize that you have written out in this Bible that you've given to us all of these terrible things that were to come to pass. You've given us the reason, and Father, we praise you for it. You've given us the end of the story. We praise you in Jesus' name.